The thing I've been thinking about is how many other people in Washington and former office holders are now tiptoeing out to the garage this week and starting to look through the files.
Oh, God. I mean, reporters, too.
You know, I can't help but thinking every time this classified document stuff comes up, you guys remember, Evan, maybe we're dating ourselves, Jane and I are, the great Sandy Berger document scandal in which he literally was stuffing classified documents in his underpants to take them out of the National Archives.
Okay, here's a trivia matter for you. Hmm. Guess what? When you mentioned Sandy Berger, his lawyer, Richard Sauber, was the same lawyer who is now Biden's lawyer in the White House handling this issue. So this is his, you know, redux for
everything
the classified scandals.
Well,
talk about a niche specialty.
Welcome to The Political Scene, a weekly discussion about the big questions in American politics. I'm Evan Osnos, and I'm joined by my colleagues, Susan Glasser and Jane Mayer. Hi to you both.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
I'm okay. Thanks. Hi, Susan.
Hey, guys. Great to be with you.
The Select Subcommittee on the Weaponization of the Federal Government was launched on Tuesday. This powerful new committee has the authority to investigate the federal government and how it has collected, analyzed, and used information about Americans. This includes gaining access to sensitive documents and covert actions. All of that falls under Congress's typical oversight authority, but this committee is very clearly being viewed as a way for Republicans to advance a narrative that conservatives are systematically under attack.
We don't want to go after anyone. We just want it to stop. And we want to respect the First Amendment to the Constitution that the greatest country in the world has. That's what this committee is all about, and that's what we're going to focus on. That's what we're going to do. And I yield back to the gentleman. Appreciate him.
At the helm of the subcommittee will be Representative Jim Jordan, a combative ally of Trump and co-founder of the Freedom Caucus. So before we get into the subcommittee itself, we thought we'd take a look at the man behind the mandate. Susan, how did Jim Jordan come to prominence in the Republican Party?
Evan, I'm glad we're taking this as our subject this week, I have to say, because in many ways, he may not be the public figure, household name that, you know, Kevin McCarthy is, but to me, Jim Jordan really has become something of a shadow speaker for this new Republican majority in the House. He really has emerged from outside rebel and insurgent in the Republican Party to essentially taking over the mechanisms and the machinery of government. And I think in some ways he was the backstage machinator behind Kevin McCarthy's very narrow win, and he will emerge with the power as a result of it. But yeah, Jim Jordan is an unlikely figure. I think most people, what do they know about Jim Jordan? They know that he's the guy who refuses to wear a jacket.
He is the most committed opponent of sleeves in the United States Congress, as far as I can tell.
That's right. He hates blazers almost as much as he hates Democrats. So people know that about him. They know that, he was a bulldog of an ally for Donald Trump. Wherever there was trouble for Trump, they would put Jim Jordan in and suit him up, no pun intended, to be the big defender. But he is the sort of archetype, I think, of the new House Republican. He comes from Ohio. He is famous in Ohio as a four-time high school wrestling champion. Later, his wrestling career, a subject of some real controversy because there were allegations of abuse on the Ohio State team when he was an assistant coach. Some of his former team members have come forward and said that he had to have been aware of this abuse. He has hotly denied that for years. But in addition to wrestling, which clearly is a sort of precursor of the pugilism he would bring to politics, Jordan has been essentially a career politician, which is ironic for someone who makes his living off of bashing career politicians. But in fact, he was been in Congress ever since he was elected in 2006.
Jane, you've watched him move through these different moments like the Benghazi hearings, January 6th. What kind of role has Jim Jordan played throughout that process? What strikes you about his significance?
First of all, I think just it's interesting to look at the image that he has cultivated with this suitless, jacketless thing is the sort of kind of menacing physicality that looks like he's ready for a fight. He's a brawler. Mm. And in these committees, I think what he has mastered, first in Benghazi maybe, and certainly in his approach to the January 6th investigation, is an expertise in twisting the facts and taking them out of context in order to hurt the other side. He's not a truth seeker. He's not somebody who's looking to get to the bottom of a problem, which is sort of the early history of these congressional investigations. He's not a problem solver. He's a pugilist who is a partisan, who's trying to smash the other side. So if you take the Benghazi thing as a really good example of it.
So here's what troubles me. Your experts knew the truth. Your spokesperson knew the truth. Greg Hicks knew the truth. But what troubles me more is I think you knew the truth.
I think they had at least 13 hearings. It was an investigation of a bloody uprising against the American consulate in Benghazi, Libya, that took place on September 11th, 2012, in which at least three Americans died. And you would have thought that this had never happened before. It was the most scandalous thing that ever happened, and that the effort was made to really tarnish Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and try to damage her potential run for the White House with all of this. And what I found interesting about it was the way, again, Jordan's an expert in taking things out of context and ignoring history. And you would never have known, for instance, that there were four deadly attacks that ended up in losing American lives in Beirut in 1983 and 1984. And when Reagan was asked about it, he said, oh, well, you know, the reason we didn't do better security, it's kind of like, you know, when you try to renovate your kitchen, it always takes longer than you think to get the job done. Now, you can imagine what would happen if Obama had said something like that or Hillary Clinton had said something like that. But the point is that Jim Jordan takes things out of context and twists them in order to get partisan advantage. And moving on to January 6th, he was apparently deeply involved. We don't know the whole story still. There were some messages that appeared that suggested that he was in touch with Mark Meadows, Trump's chief of staff, on January 5th, and suggesting that it was possible Vice President Pence could just ignore the electoral vote, throw it out from the states where they disputed the outcome. And then he's defended Trump hugely on January 6th and said it was just a patriotic kind of episode.
President Trump said peacefully and patriotically make your voices heard. We heard his whole speech. We watched the whole rally.
He also
video.
Said
we
fight
seen
like
all
hell,
kinds
though,
of video about that day. But that seems to be what all the Democrats care about, which frankly is all they've cared about for the last 5 years.
And these people who were protesting were expressing their First Amendment rights, which goes to his basic argument now, which is that conservatives, there's a double standard with conservatives, and that they're being picked on by the federal government, which has been weaponized against them uniquely.
And one of the reasons we don't know everything about Jim Jordan's role around January 6th is because he refused to comply to a subpoena that was issued by that subcommittee, which is an irony now that he's going to be the
issuing some subpoenas. Exactly.
You know, one of the things, as you mentioned, Jane, and as Susan, you indicated before, is that, you know, he's been one of the most devoted promoters of Donald Trump, defend him against accusations that Trump was responsible for January 6th, which gets to this larger thing that part of Jordan's rise has been his effectiveness in cultivating and exploiting Trump's vulnerabilities. In effect, he figured out early on that the way to communicate with Trump is through television. I mean, there's this kind of memorable moment when he figured out that when he said something on Fox or on CNN, that's how he got a response from the White House. And so he began to use television. It was kind of later became something that other Republicans were doing. But he was particularly adept at broadcasting to an audience of one. And I'll mention just one other thing I think is interesting. So you say, okay, he's been in Congress now for a long time.
This is his ninth term.
Yeah, he's been there for a while. One thing he does not actually have much attention to is actually legislating. There was a report done at one point by UVA and Vanderbilt where they looked at what they call the legislative effectiveness of members of Congress. And Jim Jordan ranked 202nd out of 205 House Republicans on the legislative effectiveness score. So
I actually think that's a great point, Evan, because the thing is it reflects the larger dynamic of what we're looking at on Capitol Hill right now, which is that the Republicans in the House don't have a legislative agenda. The reason that they're focusing so much on these sort of destructive investigations is it's all they've got. Hmm. They're going to try to destroy the other side, but they don't have something they're offering.
I think, Jane, to the point about how Republicans are going to go about using and abusing the platform they've been given, that's where you're going to start to see, the Jim Jordans of the world, the Matt Gaetzes of the world, somebody who's willing to shut down the House of Representatives in a kind of once in a century way, obviously, is taking, the tactics of using a branch of government as a political tool to a whole different level. But, this is a story as well, Evan, I think, about the rise of the kind of, you might call it the nihilistic right in the House of Representatives, not only not focusing on legislation, but, the whole concept of regular order. There's a whole generation of Republicans in Congress, of which Jim Jordan is, probably the most public avatar, who've never seen the House function in the way that it's supposed to. They don't pass regular appropriations bills anymore. To me, that remains the most telling metric. I know I keep pounding away at this. The House Freedom Caucus was co-founded by Jim Jordan and Mark Meadows in 2015, claiming as their first, sort of coup, forcing out one Republican speaker, John Boehner. And, the story of how they fused with Trump and became the kind of most vociferous arm of the Trump presidency and wing of the Trump presidency, Meadows ultimately becoming Trump's fourth and final chief of staff, arguably in many ways as responsible for the twin tragedies, really, of 2020, the mishandling of the COVID pandemic and then the terrible effort to overturn the election after November 2020. That was Mark Meadows on the inside, and then Jim Jordan on the outside, working with him. And I think that's the story that we're seeing once again here, except that this time, Jim Jordan isn't the outsider, but he's going to be the chairman with the gavel.
A wrestler with, I think, a hammerlock over Kevin McCarthy, basically, right?
Well, is the key dynamic. And that's what we just saw play out in tortured detail, of course, over this extended drama about installing Kevin McCarthy as speaker. And Jane, that was exactly one of the things I'm curious about, is what role did Jordan play in that process? You got the feeling that he was a sort of frenemy to this so-called friend.
Very perfect phrase for him. Because in the past, he has challenged McCarthy, and he lost. I think he realized he can't be the speaker. He's not that popular. People recognize in him that he's a destructive force, and he's not going to be the person they're going to choose. But so he held back, and McCarthy was smart to bring him in a way. He gave him a place at the table.
Keep him
close.
And
basically, Jim Jordan used the sort of the intimidation that he stirs to get the committee that he wanted, which is this oversight committee. He claims it's going to be akin to the church committee, but other experts who know the history of this area well have said that it's going to be more like the McCarthy hearings.
Susan, what do you make of how this committee is going to fit into the broader work of Congress? I mean, Jim Jordan, there is also going to be the work of the Judiciary Committee going on. There is, in a sense, the full arsenal of legislative tools that they can use. How do you see this one fitting in?
Well, first of all, it's so broad in terms of its framing, right? The subcommittee on the weaponization of the federal government, it's almost a sort of all-purpose, catch-all type phrase for any conspiracy that Republicans choose to fill it with. And in that sense, it really is reminiscent to me of, we talked about Kevin McCarthy, but, let's talk about the other McCarthy whose shadow hangs over this discussion, Joe McCarthy, whose platform initially was called literally the Subcommittee on Investigations, right? That same kind of broad, general, all-purpose tool for somebody to use, a political cudgel. And I myself don't particularly understand. I think it will be used to investigate anything that Jim Jordan or, you know, the producers at Fox News think is worth investigating. And in fact, now you have a whole new subject for Jim Jordan. It's not an accident. We're having this conversation on Friday the 13th. And, you know, what is the headline in Politico Playbook this morning that all of Washington waking up to and reading? It's Biden's gift to Jim Jordan. Jim Jordan has a new scandal suddenly to investigate, which is this question of the classified documents that were found and turned up by Biden's lawyers and have now been turned over, have caused a second special counsel to be investigating the president exactly the moment when the former President Trump was under scrutiny for his taking of classified documents with him from the White House to Mar-a-Lago. And so immediately heads turned to Jim Jordan. So that's going to be a subject that they didn't even envision was going to be a subject a week ago. We're only a week into this new Republican majority. So I think it'll investigate anything that Jim Jordan wants it to investigate.
The political scene will be back in just a moment.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
People know I take classified documents and classified material seriously. I also said we're cooperating fully and completely with the Justice Department's review.
So you've got Biden's documents. Presumably, we're going to be hearing also a lot about things like the Russia investigation. They're going to be presumably going after the January 6th investigation. This seems like the broad remit is to investigate the investigators. Jane, who else do you think might end up on this list of targets of this new committee?
Well, one of the things that they've also said that they want to look into is the relationship between the government and the huge social media platforms, because they contend there's this issue of Hunter Biden's laptop. And the figures on the right are contending that Trump would have won if the media had openly covered Hunter Biden's laptop before the election, and that this was suppressed by sort of a conspiracy between, you know, Facebook and Twitter and the Democrats, supposedly. It's hooey, but it's based on things like a cooked-up poll that was taken by the Media Research Center, which polled people and said, if you had known about Hunter Biden's laptop, would you have instead voted for Trump? And then they describe what they say is on the laptop is preposterous, is the way they presented it in this poll. They said, if you had known basically that Biden was in league with the Communist Party of China and making tens of millions of dollars, would you have instead voted for him?
So
there's sort of this bogus partisan, you know, trope beneath all of this that has been spewed through the right-wing media sphere and pumped it up. And so they will be investigating that subject, too. And, of course, anything else having to do with Hunter Biden in order to try to embarrass President
Biden. One point I'd like to make is about the FBI and the FBI director, Christopher Wray, who's been a big target of Republicans, although they haven't made him sort of a big public figure. Christopher Wray was appointed by Donald Trump in the wake of Trump's firing of the previous FBI director, James Comey, that caused and unleashed the scandal that would come to overshadow much of the Trump presidency and was essentially the prerequisite and the trigger for what became the Mueller investigation. But in Christopher Wray, Trump did not get the political loyalist that he sought. And, many of the figures around Trump wanted him to fire Christopher Wray in the immediate aftermath of the 2020 election, along with Defense Secretary Mark Esper. They didn't end up firing Wray because of the kind of huge storm that they feared it would unleash. But now I think Wray and his leadership of the FBI are going to come under great scrutiny. But I think it's very important to point out that he himself is a Trump appointee, just like the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Mark Milley, who is now going to also become a target of Republican criticisms and complaints.
But it is also a case, Susan, as we've talked about before, we might call this the political scene rule number one, which is you can never be too devoted because somebody else will outdevote you in Trump world. And so that's one of the things Jim Jordan seeks to be, is the most devoted of the acolytes and kind of buttressing his right flank. I'm curious, this Hunter Biden line of inquiry that they will be pursuing quite avidly. In political terms, Jane, it's not clear to me who that is designed to appeal to. I mean, who is actually the group that is going to be persuaded by a forensic discussion of Hunter Biden's business career and his laptop? Is that red meat for conservatives to get them out, or is that to try to persuade people who might be in the middle somewhere that this is not a team you want to be a part of?
I think in many ways it's an effort to create moral equivalency between the Republicans and the Democrats on the subject of corruption. Hmm. So what it's sort of, we've seen the Trump administration, which had one corruption scandal after the next. I mean, from many of the cabinet members to the Trump family itself. And Trump himself, of course. I mean, look, he's under investigation for multiple legal infractions of, you know, some of them quite major. And so I think what you get when you go after Hunter Biden's laptop is an effort to say, look, they're all like this. They're all in the mud. The Biden family is just as dirty as the Trump family. And maybe Biden himself is what they're hoping to say. I don't think anyone who's really looked at this carefully, including our former colleague Adam Mentus, who's now at the New York Times and is a terrific reporter and has looked at this incredibly closely, as the Times did this week, they have not found a evidence that Biden himself was in any way implicated in any wrongdoing. What you do see is that Hunter Biden seems to have tried to profit off of his dad's kind of reputation and power and kind of cronyism sort of stuff. But that doesn't lead you to where they'd really want to go, which is the president.
And part of that whataboutism campaign of saying, in a sense, everybody is equally dirty. It seems, Susan, that got in its own way a kind of unexpected boost with the discovery of these Biden classified documents, some of them at the think tank that he ran in Washington, and then some of them at the in a garage at his home in Delaware. I mean, let's just state obvious. Let's sort of like be clear about this. How do these two cases compare, Susan? I mean, the Trump situation and the Biden situation.
Well, Evan, we don't know what we don't know. And frankly, this week is a good reminder of that. Unfortunately, the Biden administration seems to be following another long-established playbook in Washington, which is telling the truth awfully slowly. And just in a few days' time, this went from, oh, that we just found a couple things, it's no big deal, to, oh, actually, there's even more stuff. And actually, it is in Biden's home. You know, this was Biden who was moralistically lecturing the country on 60 Minutes about how irresponsible and almost inconceivable it was that Donald Trump would have made off with a trove of classified documents, only for us to discover belatedly months later that he himself also had classified documents. So let's be clear on that, first of all. Second of all, it's not just a matter of, well, these aren't exactly the same things. Now you have a literal parallel because you have two special counsel. And this is a remarkable thing. I was racking my brain to try to figure out, you know, any comparable example, and I really can't. Many presidents have had various kinds of special counsel investigations that have bedeviled their presidency, but the idea that a president and his main partisan rival, in this case, former President Trump, would both have special counsels investigating them for similar allegations is really a political scenario without much precedent, as far as I can see. So it's not just a false equivalence, you know, from cable news pundit. There is actually an equivalent at this point in time. Now, with all that being said, what we know so far indicates that there is a significant difference in scale and scope, that, you know, it doesn't seem to be the same amount of documents by any means. It's possible that this is much less sensitive information. What's been reported about the information that Trump had was that it included some of the nation's most sensitive secrets, signals, intelligence, things related to nuclear weapons. So, you know, we don't have any indication at this point in time that it is either that level of seriousness or that amount of documents. And then the third factor that really has distinguished the Trump case and probably made it a case in the first place was Trump's refusal to cooperate. So what we know so far indicates that there is actually a difference. But from a political vantage point, again, I think it just underscores the overall point that Jane just made, which is Americans, you know, they're not going to sift through this for the nuances. They already believe that Washington is a swamp, as Trump invariably puts it, and that, you know, both parties are hopelessly corrupt and tainted. And if one is a little bit more than the other, maybe that doesn't make such a big difference to them. It's terrible, terrible timing and optics and politics for the Biden White House.
And maybe I keep reading, you know, Democratic experts, legal experts saying, actually, this is a helpful thing to the White House that Merrick Garland appointed an independent counsel to look into this as well, because it frees up Jack Smith, the independent counsel who is investigating Trump's mishandling of classified documents, to do his thing without having to worry about looking like he's picking on Trump in some way for partisan reasons. Now you've got sort of both of them being investigated. I have to say, I really don't see it that way.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to say, yeah.
It sounds a little too clever by half.
I don't know. Having watched years worth of independent counsels, it is really the rare one that that just says, "Oh, I didn't find anything." You get a clean bill of health. I mean, these things become hunting expeditions like nobody could believe.
Yeah,
and God knows what they'll find and how far they'll go. And in his effort to be above politics, Merrick Garland has now, the person he picked to be the independent counsel that looks into Biden is a former Republican U.S. attorney in Maryland, Robert Herr, who was in the Trump administration. You know, this is not from one standpoint, it's the right thing to do. From another standpoint, meaning the political standpoint, it is a tremendous risk they are running at this point.
When you look back at the history of independent counsels, exactly as you say, Jane, I mean, this is investigations beget investigations. And the history tells you that these things have a way of spiraling in directions that you can never expect at the beginning. You know, look up the words Whitewater and everybody will be able to fill in the rest. I mean, that is the history of a Clinton presidency.
So true.
I think we should dip back into history for a moment here, because in some ways the precedent that people are looking to as they think about what this committee on the quote-unquote weaponization of government might approximate is the Church Committee. This is, of course, a sort of seminal moment in how Washington thought about the powers of investigation, the agencies that are capable of doing it. It was 1975, and Senator Frank Church, who was a Democrat from Idaho, convened the committee.
There has never been a full public accounting of FBI domestic intelligence operations. Therefore, this committee has undertaken such an investigation. Its purpose is not to impair the FBI's legitimate law enforcement and counter-espionage functions, but rather to evaluate domestic intelligence according to the standards of the Constitution and the statutes of our land.
How do you think about the relationship, Jane, between what we're seeing now and what the Church Committee meant?
Well, I mean, Jim Jordan has actually made the comparison himself. He said this is going to be like the Church Committee, which so he set himself up for that.
And is it a fair comparison, you think?
No. I mean, we don't. Well, first of all, we have not seen what Jim Jordan's going to do. Perhaps he will surprise us. The oversight role is a legitimate role and an important function of Congress. Okay, let's just say that, too. And if he does it responsibly, maybe there'll be some legitimate comparison here. But I think when you look back at the Church Committee, you can see that it was appears to be quite different. The first thing, it was bipartisan in a serious way. It was a Senate investigation. And the second thing is it did not just investigate nebulous fantasies of a deep state. It investigated incredibly serious, historically factual wrongdoing by the FBI in particular. It looked into both the intelligence community and the law enforcement, federal law enforcement community here in Washington. And what it found was astounding. What it found was years worth of secret investigations aimed by the FBI at what they called disrupting and neutralizing what they saw as political threats to America, which turned out to be the entire left wing of America. It was, the civil rights movement. It was the anti-war movement. It was the women's liberation movement. They had agents infiltrating women's lib groups and in people's houses. But most infamously, it exposed that the FBI had bugged Martin Luther King and taped private moments of him having an affair with someone, sent those tapes to his wife so that she opened them and heard them. And then it sent an anonymous letter to Martin Luther King saying, you know what you need to do. It was when he was expected to accept a Nobel Prize, and it said, you've got whatever numbers of days to do this, which he took accurately to be a demand that he commit suicide before he got the Nobel Prize and would have been exposed, supposedly. So, I mean, you just can't get dirtier than what was being done by the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover during those days. And that's what was exposed. It was very real. And it resulted, to some extent, in this congressional mechanism that's created these oversight committees.
Well, I would say look at the difference in origin between the two committees, because partially I think Republicans here are relying on the idea of Americans' vast historical ignorance, and they don't really know what this analogy is. And, we are living proof, right, that, by forgetting so much history, it can be misused against us. And that seems to be what's going on here. But it's instructive to me that Kevin McCarthy agreed to set up this subcommittee on the quote-unquote weaponization of the federal government as a concession to the Freedom Caucus hardliners who were obstructing his speakership, and then immediately handed the gavel of that to Jim Jordan. So this was not originally something that McCarthy wanted his speakership to be dominated by. And in fact, they had not agreed to do this. It was one of the demands of the rebels who were holding it up. And it had its origins last summer in the immediate aftermath of the FBI raid on Mar-a-Lago and the classified documents. And you had some veterans of the Trump administration, including his former budget director, Russell Vought, coming out publicly and saying, we need a church-style committee to investigate this as part of all the wrongdoings of the FBI, quote-unquote. And months went on. This became a talking point among the conservative media. Just days into the speaker fight, in fact, it was Tucker Carlson who went on Fox and said, we need a church-style committee. And this then became one of the demands of Matt Gaetz and the rebels who were holding up the McCarthy speakership. And then McCarthy caved on that, along with a lot of other things that were on their agenda. So I think the origins of this committee are quite instructive, because it's so vastly different than the history that Jane is recounting for us.
Well, as you say, Susan, I mean, in some ways, preventing this kind of cultural amnesia and allowing this instrument to be used in a partisan way instead of a bipartisan way is part of why it's important to talk about the specifics of what happened then. A final thought on this question of the new era of investigation that we're entering now under Jim Jordan. I'm curious what each of you is going to be looking for. Jane, what's top of mind for you?
You know, there's an oddity about Jim Jordan's career, which is that he stays in the House. He didn't run for the Senate when there was an open seat in Ohio. He didn't run for the presidency. He's not actually the speaker. He seems to maybe be holding back, and you kind of wonder, does he know something? Is there more to know about all this? So that's what I'm waiting to see that.
Susan, what about you?
I do think the question of whether this is really Jordan's breakout moment or not is an important one. Is he going to make the leap to household name, Joe McCarthy, for a modern social media era? Or is it going to live in the realm of the kind of alternate alt-right kind of conversation that never really breaks through to a broader audience? You know, there's so much riding on this now, and he has to make a very difficult leap from House insurgent to House power broker. And this is a big test for Republicans. Can they shape and define and use and weaponize a platform of government themselves? Talk about mirroring. They're investigating the weaponization, quote unquote, of the federal government, but it's exactly the moment where they're seeking to weaponize their majority in the House of Representatives.
Well, before we sign off today, we've been talking, I know, about some of the harsher side of Washington, and I think all of us wanted to pause to talk about a very different thing, just for a moment. And that is something that people don't often see, but there is a community, in a sense, of people here, and all of us are thinking about someone who we lost this week, Blake Hounshell, a journalist, well-known to a lot of folks here and in the community, who died suddenly. And Susan, I know that he was somebody who you knew particularly well.
Well, you know, it's been a tragic week in Washington and for us personally. Blake, for more than a decade, was my literally closest friend, collaborator, and partner over the course of two different news organizations. Blake worked for me and was my deputy and partner at both Foreign Policy magazine. And then in 2013, this great opportunity came to me to be able to start Politico magazine. And I couldn't envision doing it without Blake. And so we moved over there together and then spent a number of years together at Politico. And to see him become, this sort of beloved journalism figure. He was one of the great minds that I've ever encountered. And, you know, for more than 10 years, we had a robust, intense, daily, million times a day conversation. And so to see, you know, him battling at the same time this long-term illness of depression, which ultimately claimed him, leaving behind two small children and a wife, it's been, I can't think of any tragedy that has, you know, struck me so close to home in my whole life, really, Evan.
There have been some very fond remembrances of him, and I hope that listeners have a chance to go back and learn more about his life.
You know, I think people think of Washington as you know, a shark tank or a swamp or both. And I think what this tragic death did was show that in many ways, it despite the competition among reporters and the warfare that we cover between the two parties, it's a small community, and people actually really do care about each other.
And that community of people here in Washington, the ups and the downs, we'll be talking about it again next week, and I'll look forward to seeing you both. Thanks to you, Jane, and thanks, Susan, as ever.
Thank you so much, guys.
Thanks, guys.
This has been The Political Scene. I'm Evan Osnos. We had production assistance today from Alex D'Elia and Emily Elias. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Allison Leighton Brown. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.